Legal 116, this is your podcast for week one. For this week, you have a few goals and some expectations for grasping things that I'm going to discuss here. One of the main functions of the assignment this week is to just start to think about the difference between civil and criminal law and the expectations, and there are some significant differences in expectations. The other things that I'm asking you to be able to grasp and to begin to master, you should be able to define litigation. You should be able to define or distinguish criminal litigation from civil litigation. By now, you should hopefully have a good vision and idea of the structure of the typical court system, and especially the Illinois system, and understand what the function of any appellate court would be. You should be able to differentiate between subject matter and personal jurisdiction. And if you don't know what I'm talking about there, you really should go to your law dictionaries. You should look at what those things are. I'm going to talk about it here, but you need to understand what those two things are and the difference, and especially if you want to be successful in this course, but more so if you want to be able to work in about most of the types of jobs that are going to be available to a legal assistant or paralegal, because most of the work is in civil law. In addition, you need to be able to explain what venue is. You need to be able to explain the difference between procedural rules and substantive law. And you should be able to explain the difference between the various legal and equitable remedies that are available in a civil case. So let's start off with litigation. My definition: litigation is a process by which the disputes of opposing parties are administered by a neutral third party. And the neutral third party has the power to render a resolution of the dispute that's binding on the disputants, on the parties. So that neutral third party, in most cases a court, has the subject matter and personal jurisdiction, and it's that court is the proper venue to hear that matter and decide that matter. Now, civil litigation is a process by which the disputes of opposing parties are administered non-criminal by that neutral third party, by the judge, where the judge has the power to render a resolution of the dispute binding on those parties, and where the dispute centers upon the determination of the bounds of certain alleged rights, privileges, or obligations of the parties. Now, one of your assignments is to read about and distinguish between civil and criminal, but, you know, they're fairly easy to figure out. If somebody's not subject to a fine or jail time, then it's probably a civil matter. And you've heard in other classes probably, and if you haven't, you will, about the makeup of our court, and that's the other thing that you should be aware of. We're going to focus on Illinois courts. Illinois has a Supreme Court. It has five appellate courts. Those appellate courts and the Supreme Court only review things that happen in the trial courts, meaning they don't hear any new evidence. They just review the record of what happened in the lower court, and then they hear arguments and they make their decision based on that. No new evidence. Most of our civil litigation is addressed in the trial courts. And it really depends on what county you come from. So in this class, this group of students, I would imagine that we have people from several different counties within the Central Illinois region. It depends on how large your county is. How large the county is, meaning the population of the county, that usually dictates how large your courthouse is. Depending on how large your courthouse is, that probably also dictates how many judges you have in that courthouse. And if you have multiple judges in that courthouse, it's likely that you have different courtrooms that handle different things. And so for a courthouse like the Peoria County Courthouse, there are several different courtrooms, and those judges assigned to those courtrooms only hear certain types of cases. So there are criminal felony only courtrooms. There are civil courtrooms that only hear the cases worth the highest amounts of money. There's a chancery court that hears probate. So those of you who had wills, trusts, and estates in the spring semester, you know what I'm talking about there, probate. They also hear contract disputes, equity. I'm going to talk about equitable damages in a little while. And so they're courts of equity. You have family law courts. You have courts that hear all types of family law cases. You also have courts that only deal with children, minors. So those are the larger courtrooms. But if you were to go to, say, Marshall County, Lacon, if you're familiar with Lacon, Illinois, Marshall County has, I believe, one circuit judge, and they may have an associate judge that travels up there, but I think they just have one circuit judge. And that judge hears everything. They hear criminal cases, civil cases, every type. There's only one courtroom. So it really depends. But you should be familiar with the Illinois court system, and you will get familiar with all the different circuits, with all of the five appellate court districts and the Supreme Court. And some of you know that our appellate court situation changed for my entire lifetime until last year and all my years as a lawyer. Peoria and Tazewell County were in the third appellate district. Woodford County, McLean County, they were in the fourth appellate district. Now we are all together in the fourth appellate district, which is based in the same courtroom, or court, not courtroom, but the same courthouse as the Illinois Supreme Court in Springfield, right across the street from the Capitol. So our cases, appellate court cases, now are heard for those counties in Springfield, as Woodford County and McLean County cases were, and no longer in Ottawa, Illinois. So after having a good idea of the courthouse and having that picture of the courts and the description of the courts that I just gave you about the different judges and different courtrooms, if you have multiple courtrooms in a courthouse hearing different things, that's going to lead us to subject matter and personal jurisdiction. Subject matter jurisdiction is the court's jurisdiction over the type of case. I mentioned that, you know, there's certain types of courts in the Peoria County Courthouse that only hear like the divorce cases. And you can't take that divorce case to another courtroom on the other side of the courthouse. You have to use those judges in those courtrooms, barring any sort of, you know, conflict of interest or anything out of the norm. Subject matter jurisdiction is the court's jurisdiction over the type of case. It's related to questions we ask ourselves when we're doing legal research. So some of you know that, you know, one of the first things we try to ask ourselves is, this state or federal law? Is this an issue that state or federal law applies to? That's going to tell us, if you're in downtown Peoria, do you go up on Monroe and Main to the federal courthouse and file your case, or do you go a block south to the Peoria County Courthouse? Two blocks south, I guess. East. Two blocks east. And you file it there. Is it a civil or criminal case? And then, as I said, depending on the size of the county or jurisdiction, there may be specific courts within that county courthouse, as an example, that only hear family law cases, criminal law cases and that sort of thing. Now, when you're filing something, you go to one place, the circuit clerk's office. But where that case is going to end up as far as the judge is going to hear it will depend on that subject matter jurisdiction. Contrast that with personal jurisdiction. When you hear the word personal jurisdiction, you should think the court's ability to compel a party to appear in court. The court's power over an individual to compel them to appear in court. And you may see this occasionally on the news about somebody failing to appear when they've been subpoenaed or summoned to appear in court. And if they're a party, what that means is in the, say, a defendant in a civil case, if they fail to appear, then you can get what's called a default judgment against that individual, which means that the court had personal jurisdiction over them. They were properly served and properly requested to appear, and they did not appear. And so the court will enter a judgment against them based on their lack of appearance. Now, a court must have both subject matter jurisdiction, the authority to hear and decide that type of case, and the ability to exercise jurisdiction over parties, personal jurisdiction. They have to have both of those in the same case. These are two things you need to have clear in your mind. So I would suggest you go over this and go over it and go over it. Use whatever resources you need. But these are going to be things that you must know. Now, when we think of the term venue is related to jurisdiction. And we always think of jurisdiction and venue as going together. My suggestion is that you think of venue geographically with, you know, close your eyes and picture a map of the state of Illinois. Think about the geographic locations of counties and courthouses within those counties. As you learn in legal research, the state and federal court systems are divided up geographically with defined boundaries for certain courts. Now, just as a court must have subject matter and personal jurisdiction to hear a particular case, the plaintiff must file a case in the proper venue in the proper county. As an example, we discuss where you must file different types of cases in many courses in this program. A divorce case, as an example, for those of you who have family law in the spring, has distinct possibilities. There's one or more choices potentially depending on the status or the domicile where the parties are living at the time the case is filed. Most of the civil cases that we deal with, and we're going to kind of focus, I think the case that I'm going to use this semester is going to be a personal injury case. Those are typically going to be limited to the county or location of the court where the accident or incident, the incident that caused the civil harm, occurred. Excuse me. So think of venue in terms of geography. And it's really going to help, if you get that picture of those jurisdictions in your mind. In legal research, if you've had the course, I lead you to the maps that are available on the Illinois courts page that break down the circuits and the counties within the circuit and the appellate court districts and the counties within the appellate court districts. And you can always go back to those. And those of you who haven't had those things in legal research will certainly go and use those resources, and nothing stops you from doing that today or now before you're directed to do it in that class, but you definitely should understand that. And then the last terms you need to begin to memorize and apply, besides the damages that I'm going to talk about after this, would be the concepts of procedural and substantive law. As some of you know from having me in other courses, both the legal studies and the law enforcement criminal justice courses, this is easiest to remember if you associate or remember that procedural law is the how we do something. Procedural law tells us how we do something, how we're supposed to proceed with a particular thing to be able to have it proceed through the court system. In Illinois, for civil cases, we have the Illinois Supreme Court rules and then local court rules that provide procedural expectations. And then we have a statute known as the Code of Civil Procedure that provides the substantive law or the what in our civil law. Those of you who have had my criminal law course will remember that this is analogous to our criminal statutes that define Illinois criminal acts, Illinois criminal code, that tells us what the elements of a battery or a robbery, etc., are, the what. And then the Code of Criminal Procedure, for those of you who had CRJ 230 and 227, we have codes of criminal procedure, both at the federal and state level, that guide us as to the expectations for how criminal cases will be moved through the court system, the how. So, again, procedural is the how, substantive is the what. So when you come across the procedural acts, they're going to tell us how we do things, and the substantive statutes, the substantive law, tells us what the thing is. Another example would be the Illinois Code of Civil Procedure tells you what a complaint is in Illinois and what the complaint has to contain, what has to be within the complaint. But the Supreme Court rules and then local rules tell you what they expect as far as filing the complaint, proceeding with the complaint, etc. So let's move into damages, and that'll be our last topic. Depending on the facts of the case, the applicable statutes or common law that facilitates the claim, in addition to jurisdiction and venue, you need to figure out which legal remedies are available in a particular Illinois civil case. Now, most cases are going to deal with money or compensatory damages. Money damages are damages that can be expressed in dollars or cents. All legal remedies involve money damages. When you hear the term compensatory damages are awarded to a party who has proven that the other side is at fault and the damages were thereby sustained. It's designed or intended to place the party receiving damages in as good a position as they would have been in had that wrong not taken place. In other words, in, say, an auto accident case, the cases you see people advertising on TV to get clients to come in so they can represent them in an injury case, those cases are going to seek to place the party receiving the damages in a position they would have been in absent the accident. That's going to seek to make them whole. There's really no way to make somebody whole necessarily in those cases, except by providing them with compensation. And the compensation is going to be by way of money damages, a dollar amount. Now, along with those, we may see these terms used. So, special damages, compensatory damages, which are precisely calculable. And they're evidenced by bills or invoices. So, within our civil case, we will be seeking special damages, specific amounts for things that we can, you know, show or evidence by bills or invoices. Now, most often that's by, you know, medical bills, as an example. The plaintiff was injured, the plaintiff had to receive medical care, surgery, physical therapy, whatever it is, they have medical bills. We would present those medical bills as part of our damages or our claim for damages and the amount we would ask the jury to award. General damages are different from specific damages. General damages are those compensatory damages that are not capable of precise calculation, but they have to be estimated. Now that's going to be pain and suffering, most likely, or future disability, because you can't exactly put a dollar amount on that. Now, in the future, if they have future medical bills, yes, we would know, but the case is concluded by then. So our special damages are those medical bills for the treatment, the physical therapy, the surgeries, the things that we knew about at the time we're going to the jury. The general damages are the compensation damages, where we estimate or we try to come up with a dollar figure that would represent compensation. We'll get into that in greater detail, and especially towards the end of the semester when you're actually going to come up with the value of a case that we're going to work up. Punitive damages are designed to punish. They're designed to discourage future parties from engaging in wrongful behavior or to provide an incentive to future plaintiffs to a risk of bringing an otherwise expensive or difficult lawsuit. Punitive damages are not available in most cases. Punitive damages in Illinois can't be brought unless the judge gives you authority to seek those punitive damages. There's a whole process, but so right now I want you to consider punitive damages is something we won't be messing with or thinking about or seeking in this class or the case we're going to work up in this class. Punitive damages come up in those rare situations where the action was so egregious. You know, the example that always comes to my mind is a case from a long time ago where there were a carload of college students riding in a vehicle produced by Ford Motor Company. The vehicle had a defect that Ford knew about and could have spent, I think it was somewhere around 5 cents per vehicle on, to help prevent essentially the vehicle from exploding in flames when struck from behind. The gas tank was positioned in such a way that it was at an angle, and there was this piece of metal that protruded that could have been kind of covered up or eliminated. I don't remember which. In any event, there was such an accident and the college students who were in the car perished. And the court allowed punitive damages in that instance. We're not going to deal with it too much after that, but I do want you to understand that money damages is what we're going to seek most. Those money damages are typically for compensation, although we do break out special damages, which are precisely calculable, and that's going to be, you know, medical bills as an example. But most of the things we're going to seek are going to be general compensatory damages as far as the total dollar amount. Now, there are certain types of civil cases where we have equitable remedies. These are typically only applicable where money or compensatory damages will not suffice. Most of the time when we're seeking equitable remedies, we're dealing with a contract case or something that we're asking the court to order a party to stop doing or to do. So, you know, the two primary remedies that I want you to remember are injunctions, which direct a wrongdoer to perform a certain act or conversely stop performing a certain act. And then the other is specific performance, which requires a breaching party. So typically, so this is going to be a contract action, requires a breaching party, a party who's breaching the contract, to perform the obligations of that breach contract. And it generally requires that the object of the contract be unique. It's something that you couldn't go out and mitigate your damages. and you need the court to order them to do that. Now, sometimes these equitable remedies seeking to have a specific thing occur may also have other damages. So they're not exclusive in that sense. I've given you a lot to think about. If you need to listen to this again, to write notes, to take notes, to list the terms, to look up the terms in your legal dictionary, to, you know, whatever you need to do to get these things down, I'm going to suggest you do that. This is developing language. It's developing language that is different for you. It's developing language and terms that you're going to have to implement and practice. You're going to have to use in practice. You're going to have to apply for the benefit or the needs of a client. And it's in your best interest to spend the time this week and right away to develop this language. It's going to serve you in the coming weeks of this class. You're going to be less lost. And if you don't do it, you're going to be very lost. And it's definitely going to serve you better in your career. Now, many of you know at least a majority of these terms, and it may just be a refresher, but all of you need to do this. So I urge you to do that. This is your week one podcast. Just to remind you, so the course was originally set with a class time, but we haven't done class necessarily in the legal studies classes for some time. We've used the time that was scheduled for more or less what I would call the firm meeting, where you came in and you asked questions and you got clarifications, and you were expected to do exactly this, but we didn't have a lecture. That's bad TV on Zoom. That said, for this semester, I will be available on Tuesday nights at 6 p.m. on Zoom, and I will post that link in the course Canvas site. Otherwise, many of you know, if you need to get a hold of me, my information's on the syllabus, or you can find it on icclaw.info. We had a little website faux pas in May, and so it's not net anymore. It's icclaw.info. And there's also a QR code on the little graphic on the Canvas site that you can use as well. I look forward to seeing what you produce this semester. Again, if you need to get a hold of me, please do. Stay well.